Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome back to Beyond the Cover, hosted by Sean Robbins up there. Jeff, how you doing?
Doing great. How's it going?
It's going good. We got the new hi-fi shit going on here tonight with the radio show. I'm not really sure what that means, but hopefully that means that people can listen to it better. I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, we'll check it out.
But tonight's show is a special show. It's going to be our first show. We're not sure how many we're going to have yet because we're not good at math. So we haven't figured out the interview time. But this is our first Thriller Fest 2015 on-site interview, starting it off with David Morrell, then Mark Alpert, and then Sandra Brown. So I guess we picked three pretty good ones to kind of kick it off.
Absolutely. And yeah, I thought we were off the entire month of July. So I don't know what the deal is, but that's cool.
I know. Yeah, but we'll be back in 2 weeks. With Kevin O'Brien, though, so he can scare
That's
the
right.
hell out of us, and that'll be fun.
Yes.
Now, some other things real quick, though, because you're going to be able to hear Joseph Fender, we have Scott Chereau, we have John Land, we have Jamie Frevoletti, we have Peter James, we have Hank Philippi Ryan. I mean, you know, we got Joseph Padal. We have a lot of people that you're going to be hearing Thriller Fest interviews, and this, like I said, is just the first one that we're going to be having this show. And let me do some quick cleanup here, though, because you and I both love this author. And that is, and her first book is now out, and I think it's been 5 or 6 years, but it's Gail Lynn's With the Assassins. And if one thing you can say, David Baldacci, Nelson DeMille, Lisa Gardner, and Douglas Preston all agree that this is a thriller and a book that you need to pick up. And it's not often that all five of them are going to agree on anything, especially like what to drink for, you know, at the bar. So make sure that you pick up Gail Lynn's and The Assassins. And I know that you've been reading that one, Jeff.
And well, actually, I reviewed it for AP and loved it, loved it, loved it.
Yes. And also, here's another one we got. The ITW winner for Best Paperback Original 2015 for Moonlight Weeps, Vincent Zandri is back with his latest book called Twisted, well, it's not called, but it's Twisted, Paranoid, and Scary, and it's called Everything Burns. So you want to make sure you check out VincentZandri.com for more information. Again, he is the winner of the 2015 ITW Award for Best Paperback Original for Moonlight Weeps, and this one is called Everything Burns.
Sounds painful.
One more thing to jump out with you here. And we've talked about this group for a long time, and we're going to have one of their authors on in 2 weeks of Kensington. And Daniel Palmer, I don't know if you read this one yet, Constant Fear.
Yeah.
But they are saying that Daniel Palmer now, you know, who's picked up writing for his father, Michael, he did, I think he finished the last book. His latest book is now out called Constant Fear. You can also check out Desperate, which was the last one out. One of the best thriller writers today, says Publishers Weekly, and Nail-Biting, sure to get hearts pumping, bound to be a winner with fans of Greg Isles and Iris Johansson, says the Library Journal. So make sure you check out KensingtonBooks.com/Daniel Palmer. You can go to DanielPalmerBooks.com, or you can just go to KensingtonBooks.com and check out all their authors. Again, we're having Kevin O'Brien on next week. He's probably one of my favorite Kensington authors. Not only is he just very freaking funny, which is really funny, because he's really funny, but then he's really freaking scary. So I don't really know how that's going to work, but it's just great. And Kevin's a good friend of ours.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so first off is David Morrell, Jeff. Do you remember sitting down, we speaking with him? We should preference this, because we wanted to get everybody about 15 to 18 minutes. That don't happen with David Morrell, people. It takes him 15 to 18 minutes maybe to read the menu of a McDonald's, but that's about the shortest time you're going to get. And it was a wonderful conversation. In fact, I think we lost track of time when we were talking to him.
Absolutely.
But you know what? He does say a couple of very interesting things in there. And the one thing is there going to be another Rambo movie? Because he answers that in the interview because he did say that he has been talking with Sylvester Stallone the last couple months, and he's going to say whether or not there's going to be another Rambo movie on the horizon. So you find out a lot of information about Thomas DeQuincy, his character and Inspector of the Dead, his latest book, which was the sequel to Murder as a Fine Art. And David's just a great guy.
Absolutely.
So you ready to do it?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
All right, sir. Here we go. Now, about 6 minutes and 11 seconds in, for some reason, I was recording and something happened. So we lost about 7 seconds of tape before it jumps back up again. So if you hear a little break, six minutes and 11 seconds in, and then it catches back up, you're going to know why. So here we go with David Moreau, live at Thriller Fest 2015.
So Jeff and I are here again with at Thriller Fest with author David Moreau. David, thanks so much for sitting down with us.
Happy to be here.
And the first question we want to kind of get out is, we're asking a lot of people, like, what does Thriller Fest, now, of course, you're a founding member of the ITW, and so you've been here since the inception. You've helped thousands of authors with Craft Fest and what everything that is going on with Thriller Fest. When this is the 10th year of Thriller Fest, so it's a very big deal now, because now that you're in the 10th year. So what does Thriller Fest mean to you as an author, and how it helps new authors and everything coming in? Because you never had that when you started writing, and now these authors are able to have this support system.
Yeah, that's the thing. When I started, and this is my 43rd year, there wasn't anything remotely like a Thriller Fest with not only the ability to mingle with like-minded people who write thrillers, but also to have the opportunity to be educated. Mm-hmm. And then just to go back, in 2004, Gail Linz and I were the co-founders, and it took a year to get the organization off the ground. But from the start, we had two principles. One was that it would be an educating organization, which would not only educate beginning authors, but that it would be an opportunity for experienced authors, thriller writers, to associate with one another and raise their game. Mm-hmm. That we'd talk about what thrillers were and what we were interested in writing, and that we'd be better for it. And the second one was, because that was educating, the other one was, you know, to help people earn a living. And so I called it we'll float all boats syndrome. And that, you know, by having younger writers, let us say inexperienced writers joining us but being educated, that it would be good for everybody. And that is the case. Here we are, you know, these years later, 11 years from the organization's beginning, and I'm amazed at how many people are able to earn an income because of what they got out of the organization.
It's been life-changing for me, I can tell you that.
In what fashion?
If it wasn't for this organization, I would not be sitting here now with John interviewing you. I wouldn't be reviewing for the Associated Press and several other places.
Yes.
I review for. I wouldn't have any books published at all. And
don't you
think
that the networking, you know, people say to me, what's the one thing that you wish you'd done? And the mistake you made, or whatever you want to call it. And that is that in the late 1980s, conferences began to occur. There had been some before. There was World Fantasy Convention was the big one that I went to. But, you know, there were other conferences, and Mystery Writers of America and what have you. And I just never... you know, mind you, my son had died from cancer in 1987, and right. There's about a 5-year period there where I simply wasn't energetic.
Right.
But starting in the 90s, I started to go to conferences. But this one is unique because of its determination to help people learn and move forward. It's amazing to me how far it's come.
Yeah, I think, and of course, Thriller Fest is broken down into, you have Craft Fest, you have Thriller Fest, and it's broken into
and
a couple
Agent
days.
Fest.
Now Agent Fest, but now there's something new called Career Fest.
Yes, and I don't know even know about. So
yeah, so it's something called Career Fest.
This is bad.
And then, of course, you have Pitch Fest where people can come and speak. So there's something for everybody, whether you're a fan, whether you're an author that's been published and you're working on your craft, or you're one that's trying to be published and you're trying to work on your craft. And I think the one thing, and speak a little bit about Craft Fest, because you teach a class.
Yeah.
So people are able to come here, you know, come to New York, invest in their business, which is what their writing is, and sit down and have an hour of listening to mm-hmm. someone like yourself who has created, you know, best-selling books and has the pathway to go.
Rambo, we have to mention.
Right, and of course, Rambo, First Blood. When was that?
72. This is 43rd year.
Right, and it's still in the bookstore being sold today. Yeah, I mean, Rambo, and they were talking about, I think, Sylvester maybe trying to bring the character back again.
He and I have been talking, but it's
not going to happen.
I don't know.
Oh,
it's I just don't know this.
I mean, he could do the Expendables 4.
He's a
I guess.
Nice guy. We've been, you know, in the last couple of months, we talked for about 12 hours, off and on the phone. But it's you know, the movie business being what it is, we just don't know.
And so the big thing is, what do you teach? What is the craft that you teach? Because people are able to also buy it, even if they're not here, and hear your craft because they can buy it because everything's recorded.
Right. I'm different from many other writing instructors because I think of myself, without comparing talent, as somebody like the jazz musician Oscar Peterson. Now, Peterson started out as a classical performer. He was classically trained and performed in the great concert halls doing, you know, Beethoven and other, you know, classical composers. And one day it occurred to me, and then he switched over to become a jazz pianist. Mm-hmm. Now, these are two different, you know, classical, I mean, that's analysis, you know, that's history. It's knowing the theory and then being able to professor of American literature for 16 years. And I realized, classically trained as Peterson was. And that I knew my way around books and the history of books in a way that was unusual for a novelist. So when I teach writing, I always start with the historical background. I did a piece today about viewpoint, first person, third person, omniscient, and third person limited. And I start with the 1600s. I start with Robinson Crusoe. And why, you know, fiction had been not respected, and so the trick was how to pretend to people, how to convince people that these were actual documents, these were real people. So a lot of people believed that Robinson Crusoe was a real guy on an island, and all this stuff happened to him.
Right.
I mean, we know he wasn't, but at the time, this was taken as an actual shipwreck narrative, and written in the first person. And similar stories later, Pamela, a book in the 1700s, which purports to be an epistolary novel, a letters novel, in which a woman is hired as a servant in a grand mansion in the country, and she sends letters to her relatives about what goes on in the mansion, which people couldn't know about. You know, this was a hidden, you know, I mean, 1% of the country lived that way. And, you know, and the novelist uses, you know, it's so secret, and she loses her job. So she says Lord B and a dash, or Lady C and a dash. And this is in the county of M dash.
Right.
You know, God forbid she would lose her job. And so people read this book as the real thing, that these were real letters written by. So, you know, I follow the history when I teach the first person. I follow the why it was invented, why, you know, what the object was. And then I go up through Henry James, who changed it all by writing the Turn of the Screw and introducing the unreliable first-person narrator, who is telling us stuff that isn't true. But, and you know, because she's crazy, yeah. Or the Agatha Christie, Roger Ackroyd,
yeah.
Which is, of course, later. But, so, you know, this is all of a sudden, or, you know, Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain, we think it's ha-ha kid's book. The fact is that kid, and he tells us as much in the middle of the book, he says, I ain't going to tell you everything that happened that night. It's too terrible to think about. Lots of times I have nightmares about it. And that's the real Huck Finn. And he's handling all the nightmares he has, all these horror stories in the book, as jokes.
Right.
Or, you know, we could go up to Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye, which is another version of Huck Finn. It's hilarious until you realize this kid had a nervous breakdown. Yeah. And so what I do is teach the history of the first person so that people can... you know, appreciate, you know, how it was developed, what its strengths are, what its weaknesses are.
Which is easier to write for you?
I write first person often in the short story mode, but I only did one novel that way. I have a theory that the egotism of the I first person narrator can be really off-putting. And you know, and when I write it, I try to find all kinds of ways of writing the sentences so they don't begin with I. So that I is in there somewhere, but that it's not I did this, I did this, I did this. I think people can get really tired of it fast. And for some reason, people tend to get very verbose when they're writing the first person. They just yatter on, and they tend to have a lack of focus. And also, first-person narrators tend not to be very good about multi-sense details. It tends to be primarily a visual narrative, mm-hmm. and they don't put in the sound and the touch and the smell that is so important and really is what makes readers feel they're in a story.
Well,
so
you're also trying to, if you're trying to convey something that's happening off, that's out of their sight.
Yeah.
In the third person, you can sort of do that, but you can't in the first.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, that's another thing. Steve Barry today, in his session, I went in near the end and listened. And as he rightly points out, it's tough to plot a first-person novel because all the major incidents have to be within the first person. Otherwise, it's all hearsay and it's dull. You know, it has to have that immediacy. So anyway, when I teach, I use this historical, you know, start the same way with omniscient third person, which came after the first person, and there was a big vogue for it in the 1800s, in which now the narrator was a historian. You could believe the document because this very learned person with wealth of information was going to treat it, it's like it's nonfiction. But it isn't. And if you look at Les Miserables, the Hugo book, he digresses for 50 pages on the Battle of Waterloo. And it's wonderful. Now, today, no author would have, you know, would say, oh my God, I won't have the reader, they won't put up with it and all that. But readers in the 1800s thought nothing of having an author pretending to be a historian.
Right.
Go all over the place with the history and then come back. War and Peace is the same way. I find that's why, as you guys know, these days I'm writing Victorian mystery thrillers.
Yes.
Set in 1854, 1855, London, about a real guy named Thomas De Quincey, who wrote a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater, and scandalized England by blowing the lid off what amounted to mass drug addiction because everybody was swallowing alcohol and opium together. And my decision, I said, all right, if I'm going to write about 1850s London, I guess I should write the book as if it were written in the 1850s
right.
as a Victorian novel. And Dickens's Bleak House came out in 1853, so I thought, all right, I'll use that as the model. And, you know, so I was using techniques that Dickens was familiar with, and it was so liberating to be able to, as a historian, so to speak, come on and provide information because most people don't know anything about the Victorian era.
No.
So, you know, I'm fond of, there's a scene in Murder is a Fine Art where the narrator, in effect, says, we got to stop here because the next scene isn't going to make any sense to you unless you know about Victorian burial practices. So here's the deal on Victorian burial practices. So I do the... You know, my little historical you know, diversion, and then I get back into the... Mm-hmm. But what I've done there is allowed, and this is an omniscient narrative, I've intrigued the reader, I think, I hope, by supplying it for... It's one of those, gosh, I didn't know that moment. If you can get the reader to say, gosh, I didn't know that, in whatever fashion, you've got the reader, you know. Because
right.
They're right away interested. So, anyway, that knowing the history of how novels developed and how the narrators, the techniques developed, I think is really helpful. So that's my primary, when I teach writing, that's what I do.
Fascinating. Yeah. Now, speaking of Thomas DeQuincy, let's jump into the book
right.
for a few minutes. Because,
and they're amazing.
Yeah, so because you're one that's not known as a series writer.
Yes.
But now, Thomas DeQuincy got you to write another book.
Yeah.
Inspector of the Dead is out.
And I'm working on the third
book.
What
is it? I would argue, though, that Brotherhood of the Rose, those were a trilogy.
Yeah.
That's a trilogy.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a trilogy, too. Brotherhood of the Rose, Fraternity of the Stone,
and
League
of Nine
Fog.
Yeah.
And they were all thematically related. And the third book paid off by uniting themes that were, even though they're standalone books, the third book, League of
right.
Nine Fog, brought in elements from the that we didn't know would be brought in, but that, you know, made it a coherent whole. What I'm doing here, in 2009, I fell under the spell of I was watching a movie called Creation about Charles Darwin's nervous breakdown.
Okay.
And his daughter had died, his favorite daughter, and he was writing on The Origin of Species, and he was done. He had boils and digestive problems and heart murmurs mm-hmm. and headaches, and he was a mess. Well, what he didn't know was that he was suffering from grief and also guilt because he had recommended a treatment that killed her. And so he may have been suffering from guilt as well. And near the end of the film, Creation, a character, one of these messengers, shows up and says, "You know, Charles, there are people like Thomas DeQuincy who say that we can be controlled by thoughts and emotions we don't know we have." And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, you know, that's Freud. You know, but this movie takes place in the 1850s and Freud doesn't start till the 1890s.
Right.
So who is this guy Thomas DeQuincy? Or are they just making something up in the movie? But they weren't. And Thomas DeQuincy, in fact, it goes all the way back to 1821 with Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And the opium dreams he had were so powerful that all of civilization marched before him. And he said afterward, as he thought about it, that the human mind was more than people thought it was. And this is an amalgam of a couple of things he said, but this is the quote. That the human mind is composed of chasms and sunless abysses, layer upon layer, in which there are secret chambers where alien natures can hide undetected. Wow.
I'm going to have to play that back and listen to it again.
Wonderful.
Because
well,
that's powerful right there.
I can do it. I'll do it again if you like. I was so intrigued by
this
that he understood Freud and schizophrenia and, you know, and all the other stuff that could happen to the human mind. So I said, I'm going to write a book, a novel about this guy in which he, and Scotland Yard had just been, you know, just begun as well. So there's Scotland Yard trying to figure out crime scene analysis and things like that. And along comes DeQuincy talking. Half the time he's talking about Immanuel Kant, and he's saying, you know, have you read Immanuel Kant? You know, is reality in our minds, or does it exist outside ourselves? And these guys from Scotland Yard are thinking, this guy, this doper, you know, he's really messed up. But it turns out that DeQuincy, in the novels, using the principles of Kant, is reality in our mind, or is it outside us? Or does, you know, our mind create the reality outside us, that he uses this principle to solve these amazing, seemingly unsolvable murders. And so I just really got into it. The trick, the problem, if you liked it, if we could call it that, is that I knew that if I was going to write about Victorian London, you know, 1854-55, he published a something that year that I was going to use, so that was the date I settled on. And so off I went for 3 years, is no lie, no exaggeration, for 3 years, the only books I read were books about the 1850s and the Victorian era, fiction, nonfiction, histories and Queen Victoria and all that, culture books, what it meant to be a Victorian, how people lived from day to day. Right. De Quincey himself, he has thousands of pages that he wrote. And then there are two excellent biographies of him, one by Robert Morrison and another by Greville Windop. I love that name, Greville Windop. It's an Anglo-Saxon name. And I became friends with them. And then I became friends with Judith Flanders, who's like the leading historical Victorian person. We became really good buddies. Some days we were emails back and forth and got to meet them all. And I mean, this was 3 years of... You may remember a movie called Somewhere in Time.
I do, Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, yep. And that's based upon a Richard Matheson novel. Mm-hmm. Big Time Return, I think it's called. And there's a Jack Finney novel with the same principle.
Time and Again.
Time and Again. And in both cases, the characters concentrate enough that they go back in time. And that's what I was doing. And it was an eerie thing. I was so into that period. It's almost like I thought I was there. And I had a big map of London, and I could go around as if I lived there. Wow. And it was really, really a cool experience. And so, you know, the goal part of it was to make people believe they were truly on those streets. And you know, the reviews, well, you've been kind enough to write about it. The reviews have been, you know, very kind in relation to that sense of realism that the books have.
I say time travel exists because you can make the reader feel like they've traveled back to that time period.
Yeah, well, this is a Thomas De Quincey thing. Is reality in our minds or outside us? You know, it's possible we are all, you know, just time traveling. You know, so it's a... So anyway, I did two, Murder is a Fine Art, Inspector of the Dead is the second one, the newest one, and there'll be a third one. This was conceived as a trilogy. The third one will be called Ruler of the Night, and it's going to be, you know, it's readers, these are standalones, but what readers don't know is in each book I embedded some things that are going to pay off
in the third one.
And we'll bring it all to a really... You know, De Quincey said, for a murderer to be considered as an artist, some great storm of passion must toil within him, revenge, hatred, envy, whatever.
Yeah.
And so one of the other goals in this is to see if I could go big time for villains, if we want to call that, who are so sympathetic, even though they're vile and their evilness so sympathetic that we actually can understand why they're doing this stuff. And, you know, in the case of Inspector of the Dead, the recent one, I hoped, you know, as we discovered eventually what happened to the villain, that we would be tempted to cry for him, that we would feel moved to say, oh my God, you know, what this man has suffered. And this all, you know, and in effect, I'm just using De Quincey's theories in order to make these books, you know, do what I want them to.
Fascinating. I mean, 3 years of your life spent just immersed into that era.
It was so wonderful. It was just so fascinating. The deeper I got, but I wasn't going to be happy until I knew what sections of London had which paving stones. And, you know, whether they were dirt or cobble or concrete paver, granite pavers, or, you know, what kind of money was in their pockets and things like that. It got deeper and deeper. And sometimes Judith Flanders and I, she's also, it's a good time to give a plug for Judith, because she's not only a prize-winning historian, but she also writes mysteries about a British book editor. It's all about the modern book world and all that. But at the same time, it's, you know, this book editor is hilarious. So a female who's basically Judith, who falls into these, you know, these crimes that she hadn't planned on being part of, and it's really exciting. One's called the titles aren't coming to me because they're something of something. One is something of scorpions and something of magpies is the best I can give to you right now. They're wonderful books.
So for people who want to dive more into and out of the fiction and into the nonfiction part,
sure.
You would recommend Judith Landers.
Oh, yes, The Victorian City.
You would recommend those.
Yeah, The Victorian City is, she's written a lot of other books, and I have shelves and shelves of Victoriana, but if we wanted one book that would really explain what it was all about, it would be Judith Landers' The Victorian City.
Nice.
Do you see, when you're done with the trilogy, do you leave an opening for him?
Oh, sure. He's not going to die because he didn't die. This is 1854, 1855. Right. He didn't die until 1850 or 1859.
Oh,
so I can't.
Oh, you got five more years on him in there.
But I don't know, you know, this one I'll have used up what I think are all the big, what we call, I don't know, Victorian set pieces. There was, for example, the Crystal Palace. In 1851, the first World's Fair occurred in Hyde Park, and it was a brainchild in part of Prince Albert, who was really pushing the idea of the Victorian era. I mean, he was sort of her press agent in a way. A lot of the ideas about Victorian are his. And he said, we're going to have this grand World's Fair, which nobody had ever imagined could happen.
Right.
And we'll bring all the members of the Commonwealth and that empire controlled a third of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was the largest empire that ever existed and still hasn't existed. And they were going to bring it, and they'd bring other people like the United States and all that, but it had one function, to show how massively powerful the British Empire was. That was its purpose. Now, how are they going to house this thing? What were they going to do? And they were looking at various ways to do it. And Albert knew a guy who designed a massive greenhouse for somebody. And he said, we'll do it as a greenhouse. It'll be 5 stories tall. It will cover, I forget how many, 40 acres. And it will be all glass with iron connectors. And it was called the Crystal Palace, and it took up much of Hyde Park. And it was so huge that they were trying to figure out how to do decorations in it, you know, plants. And they said, well, we'll just leave the trees. There were elm trees that were dwarfed inside the Crystal Palace. It was so massive that 300 musicians playing together could barely be heard.
Jeez.
And that is one in Inspector of the Dead. There's a scene in the Crystal Palace. In fact, what I did on my website, on the page for Inspector of the Dead, as I wrote photo essays. Because if you Google Crystal Palace, when you see this thing, you'll say, oh my God, how could such a thing have ever existed? It is a wonder of the world. And so I have these, you know, these photo essays on my website, it was just so exciting to go in and find these places that don't exist anymore, but were, you know, at the time, a big deal. But in the third one, in Ruler of the Night, which will be out next year, I think, you know, I mean, how many grand things like there were there in the, and I've got, there are several more, then after that, you know, we'll see, maybe I'll do a fourth one, but in any case, I know for sure there'll be three.
Fabulous. That must have been where they got the soccer team named Crystal Palace.
I have no doubt. Now, they disassembled it after the...
Yeah, I was going to say, how they tear it down? It's not like the... It sounds like Noah's Ark.
It was like, you know, glass... It was a million glass frames anchored in you know, iron.
Mm-hmm.
So they just took it all apart, and they moved it south about 10 miles south of London, a place called Sydenham Hill. And they rebuilt it there. And it existed
as a monument?
No, as a continuing, but it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was, oh, we'll go see the second Crystal Palace. So they went down, you know, there was a train to it. And it existed until the Blitz in World War II, when it was destroyed. And now they're talking about rebuilding it.
Very interesting.
I've always been curious, especially after reading the two books, and can't wait for the third, by the way. How do you think De Quincey would have been living in London 35 years and later, you know, with the whole Jack the Ripper thing?
Well, De Quincey invented the true crime genre in an essay called On Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts.
Right.
Actually, he wrote three versions of it. They were installments, but the part three is the big one. He had been fascinated by a murder that occurred in 1811 in the East End, in the Wapping, on the Ratcliffe Highway, which was basically a street. It wasn't any highway that we would know about. And there were two. There was a man who ran a linen shop, and a woman. He had a servant, and he sent her out at midnight on a Saturday to pay a bill that they stayed up late on Saturday working. The people got paid late on Saturday, so business hours went on often at midnight. And she went out to pay this baker's bill and also to get oysters. And we think of oysters as being a very fancy food, but it was a common cheap food at the time, and it didn't need to be cooked.
And right.
Most places didn't have stoves. Or, you know, they didn't even cook in the fireplace. So she went out, came back. She couldn't find the baker, and she couldn't find the oyster person. And she came back, the door was locked. And she knocked on the door, and she didn't get a response. And then she heard footsteps, at least so De Quincey said. And then she heard someone stop on the other side of the door and breathe heavily. And she thought, this is not going well.
This is not going to go good.
So watchmen, they didn't have police at that time, but they had watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
The watchman comes along and he says, what's going on? She says, I can't get in and I think some stuff has happened. And the guy next door says, would you all shut up? I'm trying to sleep. And he says, all right, I'll crawl over the back wall and I'll see what's going on. He crawls over the back wall, back door's open, goes inside there, all dead. The guy around the shop, his wife, a boy who was hired that worked for them, and a three-month-old baby. They've all been bludgeoned to death by a hammer, and then their throats have been slit. And the baby's crib has been crushed by this hammer, just smashed into smithereens. It was a wicker pram, is what they would call it over there in England, and piled on top of the baby. Now, for the first time, the mail coaches, that this was a new invention. They had decent roads for a change. These were like gravel roads. It's a whole other story about how these gravel roads happened. And then they had mail coaches, which are four horses and a coach that could go 10 miles an hour. It's like a rocket ship.
They were flying.
They were flying.
Mm-hmm.
And they could travel England in 2 days. And every 10 or 20 miles, there was a relay station. It's like movies in America about the stagecoach. And they operated on a schedule. Nothing stopped them. So there were 52 newspapers in London.
Wow.
And these newspapers flew by 10 miles an hour all through England. And nobody, the closest I can think of is when we were in, not we were in, but in 1959, the events that caused Truman Capote to write In Cold Blood occurred at that farm in Kansas. No one could imagine, you know, this farm couple, you know, and what had happened to them. And so it's the same thing here. England shut down. I mean, it was terror far beyond what the Jack the Ripper thing 60 years or 70 years later would have done. Now, here's the thing. A week and a half later, that happened again.
Another family?
Yes. Same thing. And off went the coaches and off went... And again, England shut down. And what happened, they think they got the guy, but not really, right? It's very complicated, and I'd be here for another hour telling you what happened. But De Quincey was fascinated. He was there, you know, he was a young man when this event occurred, and he was just absolutely spellbound, and he collected every newspaper file he could get his hands on. Years later, right, he's bringing out, in 1854, he's bringing out his collected works, and he needs more material. So he writes the third installment on murder, considered as one of the fine arts, in which he recreates step by step from the villain's point of view and the victim's point of view, and the girl went out to do mm-hmm. pay the bills, in this what I call 50 blood-soaked mm-hmm. pages, which is the invention of the modern
true crime.
And that's why I wrote Murder is a Fine Art, because I thought, you know, Jesus, he's a drug addict, right? He's written it, I mean, you think you're there. Granted, it's a Victorian style, it's not our style, but once you get used to it, you think you're there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm hearing the guy on the other side of the door breathing heavily, you know, I mean, wow. So I thought, all right, here's what I'll do. The essay was published in 1854 in October. I'm going to pretend, De Quincey in real life was in Scotland, I'm going to pretend he's come to London in the undignified pose of having to hawk his books, to sell his books, which in England is like the lowest thing you can do. while he's there, the murders start again. And they're using, whoever's doing this is using his essay
work
as the blueprint.
The blueprint to do it.
Right. And so I thought, oh my God, you know, this is... I mean, it just fits so well.
It's fascinating.
And you know, that speaks to your comment about, you know, he would have been writing, you know, and one of the current thoughts about Jack the Ripper is that it was a hoax, that it was, that while these women had been killed, there was no relation to them at all, and Jack the Ripper did not exist, but an enterprising newspaper reporter sent the letter.
Oh.
See. So that's another angle.
Another layer on top of the...
So, wow. You know, De Quincey being De Quincey, you know, and he had vast imagination, he would have, you know, I'm sure, have, you know, concocted, you know, a wonderful essay about, you know, murder as a fine art revisited and all of that. But, yeah, he lived to be 74, and for a guy who is laudanum is a mixture of alcohol and opium, cheaply available, legally available. Everybody had it in their medicine cabinet. It was the only reliable painkiller. But if you drank a tablespoon of it, it would probably kill you. And he was drinking 18 ounces of this stuff a day.
Holy Toledo! 18 ounces.
Yeah, he was just throwing it down the way.
That's like a bottle of Coke down
there. Yeah, that's what.
But he was. It was like a bottle of wine for him. You know, just. And then he'd also eat opium tablets.
Was he ever lucid, I guess? Did he ever have lucid moment?
That's why I go back to...
It's like a modern Jimi Hendrix.
Is reality in our minds, or is it outside ourselves?
Right.
And so, and that actually the big task with writing about him was that he's so, you know, he's brilliant and he's fascinating, he's witty, and, you know, his friends mm-hmm. threatened to keep him captive and bring him out like a child's toy in a box to liven dinner parties. I mean, he was really witty. When Emerson came to England, Ralph Waldo, De Quincey was the guy he wanted to meet. I mean, he had a legendary, you know, for just being fascinating. But for all that, he was an opium mm-hmm. addict. So I had invented, Jeff knows this, in your review of Inspector of the Dead, the task was how to make this man attractive. And the answer was he had in real life his 21-year-old daughter who was his, you know, she took care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, and again, you can do this in a Victorian novel. These days it might be controversial. I did put from the journal, there's a certain point, the murders have occurred in my book, in Murders of Fine Art. The detectives have arrived, and, you know, they're new at this, at Scotland Yard, trying to figure out how to do these things. They hear about the essay and how it matches with the killings they're investigating. The guy who wrote it's this noted drug addict. he's the guy.
He must have been the guy, yeah.
So quick now they're going to go find him, right? So now it's time to introduce Thomas to Quincy. And I could have just, you know, dropped him in, but I thought, no, I need a buffer. So because Dickens used a first-person interruptive narrative in Bleak House, I thought I can do that. So I decided I put in from the journal of Emily de Quincey, and I introduced her, and we liked her so much mm-hmm. that when she introduced her father, we automatically liked him. And so that, you know, that was how I solved
kind
the problem.
Got it in
you know,
there.
People have asked me, well, why switch to the first person? I had to do it. I did not believe that people would go with me unless we saw de Quincey through his daughter's eyes.
That was a great way to do it.
Fascinating.
But it's you know...
You know, and it's fascinating that here in America you never hear of the name Thomas de Quincey, because the first time I heard of him was in Murder as a Fine Art. It's the first time I ever knew who the guy was.
The reason for that, I mean, this guy, Edgar Allan Poe wouldn't have been anybody without Thomas de Quincey. Poe adored...
Because he was writing in the 1850s.
Yeah, it comes just a little bit after.
Yeah.
Poe, all that... fuzz in like the House of Usher, you know, and mm-hmm. it's all that, like, it's kind of a, you know, drug-like.
Right.
That's Poe imitating
De Quincey.
And so I remember in the 1960s, when I was in college, you know, they mentioned De Quincey briefly, but they didn't want to really address him because of the drug thing. How good can a drug addict mm-hmm. be? But he's the only brilliant, functioning drug addict writer. Never mind Kerouac. This is the real deal. I mean, you know, it's so paradoxical that this guy would be so brilliant and so stoned. But maybe that's, you know, the stuff he was, but there he was inventing Freud. If Freud read De Quincey in Baudelaire's translation. Baudelaire loved De Quincey. And so there's a strong possibility that the dreams, because he was big in dreams,
right.
There's a strong possibility that Freud picks up the interpretation of dreams idea from reading Confessions of an English Opium Eater.
Well, David, I'll tell you, this has been fascinating. And we could go on for another 2 hours, without a doubt. I mean, I'm enthralled just listening to the story.
Well, it's just fun to talk about.
It is.
It's just so lively. It's just, this guy was just amazing. And that I could be friends with his two living biographers.
Right.
And, you know, and it was fun. Last in 2013, Manchester, England, which is where de Quincey was born, asked me to come mm-hmm. over and talk about de Quincey to the Manchester folks. You know, and then I was able to go up to Dove Cottage in the Lake District. Mm-hmm. De Quincey stalked Wordsworth when De Quincey was very young, and Wordsworth had no reputation, but De Quincey loved Wordsworth's poetry. He was like 17, 18 years old. So he went up, he wrote fan letters, and then he gave, out of an inheritance he received, De Quincey lent Coleridge £300 to be his buddy, in the hopes that Coleridge would introduce him to Wordsworth. So, and it happened. Coleridge says, well, I'm going up there, come on with me. So they go from wherever up to the Lake District to Dove Cottage, one of the most famous literary residences in literature. And De Quincey and Wordsworth become buddies, and then De Quincey decides to live in the town. It's called Grasmere. It's very small. But this is the payoff. Wordsworth says, you know, my family's so big, I'm going to have to move to a bigger place. And De Quincey says, well, can I rent it? Because he has this inheritance, not much. And so Wordsworth lived in Dove Cottage for 8 years. De Quincey moved in where his idol lived.
Jeez.
And lived there for 16 years. So I got to give a talk up there at Dove Cottage, too, while I was over there. I mean, it's just this American giving, you know, talks about...
But that's how nice, that's how small the writing community really is, yeah. Even though it's a massive international thing. It's just something just like
it's,
that.
And De Quincey saw Wordsworth on a daily basis. He tells his story. He didn't like Wordsworth in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking to Wordsworth, and Wordsworth has a... in those days, pages in books weren't cut. They were sealed. You had to cut each page in order to read it. And so Wordsworth...
that must have been when they got the term, these pages haven't been cut yet. Like they can tell the book hasn't been opened.
And you had to have people carry a little knife and they slit the pages in order to mm-hmm. part them. And De Quincey tells a story about Wordsworth. He's got a book and he's got a greasy butter knife and he uses the greasy butter knife to slice
the pages.
And I think it may have been one of De Quincey's books. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there was a lot of, you know, most of what we know about the intimate day-to-day details were by essays that De Quincey mm-hmm. wrote about these, and Coleridge and other people in the Lake District. So very cool stuff.
So now, where can people find out? What's your website?
DavidMorrell.net is in the network of whatever.
Right.
A photographer has the .com, which is all right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I do? somebody wanted me to buy a Rambo.com website name the other day, and I said, how much do you want for that? He said, $35,000. I said, I don't think so. I've gone this far.
43 years without a Rambo.com. I could go.
Have Stallone call it and say, it's Stallone. It's $500.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, davidmorrell.net,
okay.
And lots of information on it.
And you said Ruler of the Night?
That'll be the third one.
That's the third one.
That'll come out. That's what Emerson called him that.
Okay.
Thomas De Quincey is the Ruler of the Night.
Oh, okay. For that. So this, the January, February next year?
No, probably in the fall. It's not done yet.
Okay.
Right. Oh, okay.
Takes a lot of research.
Of course.
3 years just to do the book one, Jeff. You want to jump on something to pump one out in 3 months?
I was thinking 3 weeks.
Oh, yeah,
that's right.
That's great. Well, hey, David, again, thanks so much for sitting down with us, and enjoy the rest of Thriller Fest, and thanks again.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
All right.
So there we go, everybody. David,
that was amazing.
Oh, that was so good. And it was funny. And, you know, and that's the kind of funny thing, because just to hear us at the end, you know, we're just joking around, and you're just kind of, you know, hearing some. Is there in a nutshell is why you go to Thriller Fest. You can sit down with David Morrell, and he'll just joke with you. And believe me, if he starts talking, you better make sure you get a good hour. Because the stories that he will tell you, you won't want to leave at all.
It's true. I was actually surprised how much time it actually was when we were talking to him. I thought, you know, maybe 15 minutes, 20,
yeah,
the most.
No,
yeah.
No, it was gone. But now, you know what, we got to do one more thing here, because we got some killer cozies from Kensington Public Corporation. Because what's the biggest mystery this summer, Jeff? The biggest mystery this summer is what?
I don't know. You tell me.
Which killer cozy are you going to read first? Because Kensington has some great ones here. Farmed and Dangerous, Death of a Cupcake Queen, Death by Tiara, Death by Coffee. My favorite, Death of a Dog Whisperer. Not that I don't like dog whisperers. I love dogs, but the whisperer part I don't really know of, so that's good. And A Catered 4th of July. Again, you can check all that out. You can go to HavyReads.com for their cozy section of Kensington. And again, you can always go to KensingtonBooks.com. Or like I said, you can just go to the HavyReads.com. One other last thing is, what do you do when you're caught between Wearing Criminals and Ruthless Feds? What do you do, Jeff?
Pray.
Or you can load your gun, double-cross them all, and hope for the best, because that's what E.A. Ammer did in You're As Good As Dead. It's book two in the Dead trilogy. So go to EAYMAR.com. That's EAYMAR.com for more information on this. And the book that Vincent Zandri called one of the most promising and talented hard-boiled crime writers of his generation. E.A. Ammer, EAYMAR.com. Let's jump in here, Jeff. You ready for a little Mark Alpert?
Oh, I love it.
Now, I don't know how I know he got loud in the interview, but I haven't really played it back, so we'll see how it is. I might have to adjust the volume because he got a little loud. But this one is only 18 minutes long. This was about what we were shooting for. So you're going to hear Mark Alpert talk about his latest book, Six, and a lot of other things. So you ready to go, Jeff?
Let's go for it.
Let's do it.
So here we are again live at Thriller Fest with, you know, Jeff Ayers, of course. And now we are with author Mark Alpert. And Mark, we want to thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm having a great time at Thriller Fest.
Wonderful. So speaking of Thriller Fest, we were asking all the authors, and we like to know, what does Thriller Fest mean to you? And how many have you been to?
Actually, this is my eighth.
Ah, look at that. Eight out of ten.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it a lot. And to me, Thriller Fest is all about inspiration. Because you're a writer, no matter what stage in your career, you're often working by yourself, and you need to meet with other thriller writers to get inspired to write the next book, write a new kind of book, get past some part of the book that you're stuck in. And just going to all the sessions, hearing from great people like Greg Isles yesterday, that was incredibly inspiring because he was there saying, you know, don't do this unless you're absolutely committed. And that is exactly the words that you need to hear as a writer.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Yeah, so I have to ask, I know your background, Scientific American and all that, what made you decide you wanted to start jumping in the fiction business?
Well, I love explaining science, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, and I did it for many years as a journalist, as Scientific American, as an editor. I would edit stories about neuroscience, about astrophysics, and my job was to take something very complicated and turn it into something that anyone could understand.
Yeah, because that just went straight over my head. I'm not going to lie.
And usually my editing process was, you know, the Scientific American articles are written by the scientists, and so they would submit some enormous, you know, 10,000-word manuscript. Right. And my first job was anything I didn't understand, I would cut. But I would be left with something that was really amazingly fascinating, something really cool. And while I was doing this, I just come across naturally lots of great story ideas. So, for example, we did this big special issue on Albert Einstein on the 100th anniversary of his miracle year of 1904 or 1905. Those 2 years. And he was working, you know, Einstein was working the whole second half of his life on a unified theory, something that would combine relativity, which is, you know, the theory of gravity and theory of big things, with atomic physics. But he never succeeded in doing this, and that was the great disappointment of his life. But the premise of my first book, Final Theory, was that actually Einstein succeeded, but the theory was too dangerous to release to the world. So that just gives you an idea about how you can take something, you know, from the real world and turn it into a really exciting, fun novel.
So with that science background, I got to ask about the Furies.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a stretch for me. I wrote a book about what would happen if there was a group of people who had some genetic mutation where it would allow them not to age. And I thought, wow, what kind of culture would they have? What kind of community? How could they hide themselves from the world? Because in the book The Furies, they're treated as witches, and they're hounded and killed and almost annihilated. And so they wind up, of course, coming to America, the place of refuge, and they hide there for hundreds of years. And so the idea behind The Furies was try to take that seriously. If it is possible, how would that work? And so I think a lot of science thrillers follow that basic format.
And I'm just going to jump back real quick because you said that you've been here for 8 Thriller Fest. So when you came for your first one, and I don't know, did you have a book out at that time, or were you looking to get a book out? How was that first Thriller Fest experience, and what were you expecting when you showed up, and what kind of myths were bust when you got here?
Well, when I went to the first Thriller Fest for me was 2008, and my book Final Theory had just come out, and so I was in the debut class of
yes.
2008, and it was wonderful because at the debut breakfast I was sitting right next to Lee Child, and so I was able to pick his brain and talk to him and get some great advice from him. And I think one of the myths that was busted, I think, was I was noticing a lot of the book got a lot of great reviews, but I was also noticing on Amazon a lot of people were extremely angry over various parts of the book. I didn't understand. There seems to be such, I didn't know where all this negative feeling was coming from. I thought, is someone out to get me? I started getting really paranoid. And then I realized, wait, Lee Child gets bad Amazon reviews too. There are just crazy people out there who
yes.
will write. So, and then we had that, I think they used to do this at the banquet where they would say, what are your worst, they would collect your worst Amazon reviews. And I think the one from Lee Child, I think the one he submitted was something like, I read all your books. I've hated them all, but I've read them all.
That's what Bob Stein
yeah,
said. Bob Stein said how a little kid emailed him and said, I've read all your books and I hate them. And he's like, okay.
I think another comment was, this book was so bad, I wish I could unread it. And so I was thinking, wow, these top authors in the field are getting these kind of reactions too, so it's okay. So I felt very relieved at that moment.
You're getting reaction, and that's a good thing. That's what you want when, as a writer, people actually discussing your books.
Emotionally negative or positive, you're hitting them on an emotional core. And I think that that's a good thing. I mean, some celebrities like negative publicity. They don't care. Publicity is publicity. Look at the Kardashians. They get hammered all the time. They love it.
Right. And then on the other scale, you get really positive comments that make no sense either. Because I once got this comment that said, wow, you know, Final Theory, that was the best book I've ever read. And I think, you haven't read enough books. You know, I mean, so that happens too.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's talk about The Six. Mm-hmm. So I saw you the other day and I thought, you're doing a YA novel now, and so why the switch to YA, and what sort of prompted that? Yeah, see, here we go. We got a copy right here.
Well, yes. I could tell you exactly. It's the fact that I have teenagers at home, and they are reluctant readers, and that really bugs me, because when they were younger, they read all the time. They devoured books, but now, once they're getting into middle school, even in middle school, there's just so much homework that they just don't have time for it, and so they really need books that reach out and grab them. And I think a science thriller is a perfect kind of book for reluctant readers, because this is a cool idea. The idea behind The Six, it's about six dying teenagers whose lives are saved when they give up their failing bodies and they digitally transfer their mind into U.S. Army fighting robots who have to fight this out-of-control artificial intelligence. And I thought, fighting robots. If anything is going to get my kids to read, it's fighting robots. Yeah.
Yeah, and Stephen James and I agree with the premise that he said, when my daughter was in middle school, they made her read the classics, and what that did was make her never want to read again. Because you're forcing those kind of books that they're really not interested in. And so when you're writing a book like Six, and you've had your children in mind, and like you said, fighting robots, do you think that books like this, you know, made for young adults that are really fun reads, you know, and they might not be the Dickens or the Steinbecks or the Hemingways, which are really above some of those high school kids anyway, do you think that these things should be more in the popular of the, you know, the middle school, high school, and that's maybe what they should be reading more, because it gets them more excited about wanting to go out and see other authors and what else they're doing.
Right, exactly. I think lots of educators are starting to realize that this is the kind, these are the kinds of books that we have to fill our libraries with. I mean, STEM education, you know, getting kids interested in science and math is extremely important for our whole economy. And so that's why when I was a teenager, what inspired me to go into science, become a Scientific American editor? It was Isaac Asimov's I, Robot. It was the Foundation series. It was Frank Herbert's Dune books. It was Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain. These are the kind of books that I think are crucial for kids to want to learn more about science and math. And so that's what I'm trying to do with The Six.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of our listeners are people who want to become published writers. And someone like you, who's been successful with several adult novels, has a YA novel out. I wonder if you could talk a bit about how easy or difficult it was to turn around and do something like this.
You mean to switch from adult to young
adult?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I found it actually very easy because I get the impression there's a great amount of freedom in young adult. You know, that the Harry Potter and the Hunger Games books have really expanded the field so much that you could handle just about any subject. You can handle dark subjects. You can also do a lot of first-person, present tense, which actually makes the plot so immediate. And you can, I find that I'm having a lot of fun getting into the emotions of the characters that I do it in my adult books as well, but with the young adult books, for some reason, and also the fact that these teenagers are now robots, suddenly I can have them have relationships and talk about their emotions and like, you hurt me so badly. You know, after I died and became a robot, I never thought anyone could hurt me this badly, but you proved me wrong. Now, I don't know if I could ever write that among two teenagers, because I would think, oh, this is so silly. But the fact that there are two robots having this emotional argument, to me, that was really fascinating. And so sometimes when you expand into a new area, when you push the boundaries, it actually gets easier rather than harder.
In terms of your publishing side of things, so the business side of it, was it difficult on that end?
No, not really. I've had a great relationship with, I was first published by Simon & Schuster and now with St. Martin's Press. And for the young adult, we've moved to Sourcebooks, and I've been really, really happy with them, too. I mean, on the business side, I find it's kind of fun and educational to have more than one publisher sometimes, because you feel like you're an entrepreneur. It's like, wow, this is great. I have two distributors now, and it's neat because you can, on the business side, you can think about, okay, what is one publisher doing really well? And I can tell my other publisher, you know, why don't we try this? And usually my editors are great. They will say, yeah, that's a fantastic idea. Let's do that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great question. I had never thought about that when you answered it, that you could actually go back to the other publisher and kind of let them know, hey, you know what, this publisher is doing well, and this is kind of what's going on, and it's different, even though things have to be marketed a little different, because you're probably not marketing your young adult to your adult thriller writers, and maybe some of them, of course, are reading it. So when you are sitting down and having to say, now I got to do something totally different on the marketing side because my adult thrillers are on this side, now I got to do the YA, how is that experience, having to change your marketing plan to get this out to kids?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that I write adult thrillers is a bit of a help, because it gives me a little bit of, you know, name recognition for the young adult audience as well. And also the fact that I work at Scientific American, that's the kind of thing where it gives a little bit of credence to the real science, because there is always, I try to put a lot of real science behind all my fiction. But I find, yes, you're right. You're going for a slightly different market. And so the publisher, for example, sent me to this really great conference. It's the ABA's Children's Institute. They had a conference in Pasadena. And there was hundreds of bookstore owners and book buyers, most of them, you know, children's book buyers or bookstore owners. And it was so, I was so animated by the fact that it was so lively. There were so many people starting new books. Bookstores, I mean, new bookstores, entrepreneurs who, and it totally contradicted the idea that this is an industry in trouble. No, this was a thriving industry. I was just so impressed with that, and I loved meeting all the bookstore owners, and I find that I'm going next week to this International Literacy Association conference. Now, that's something, again, I would probably never do if I was promoting adult books, but because there's going to be a lot of school librarians, there's going to be a lot of school teachers, it's a great new audience for me to tap into.
Great.
That's wonderful. Yeah, one of the reasons I was asking about the whole business side of things is I was working with the people here who were pitching, trying to get an agent. And one of the people in the crowd was someone who's written 20 novels. And his agent refuses to represent that particular genre he wants to write in now, so he has to get a new agent. Mm-hmm. I was flabbergasted that he wasn't getting any results at all. No one was interested. With 20 novels to his credit, and they're great books, and I was quite surprised by that. So that's why I was a little wondering about the business side of stuff. So I guess what I want to ask is, this has just come out, and it's been successful for you so far. What is next for you? Are you going back to adult, or are you going to do a sequel to this?
I'm going to do both.
No, million-dollar question that every author does.
Yes, I am actually in the process of writing a sequel to The Six, my young adult book, and in fact, it's due in 3 weeks, so I have a lot to write. So I shouldn't even be here, but here I am.
Or the other conference. How are you doing that one?
And then with my adult thriller, I have another adult thriller from St. Martin's Press. It's coming out in February, and it's called The Orion Plan. And this is also a science thriller, and this was based on actually another Scientific American story I worked on. We did a special issue on space exploration, and I was editing that, and one of the stories I commissioned was, what about interstellar travel? I mean, how possible is it, you know, without wormholes, without warp drive, if you were just using technologies that are feasible, like fusion rockets or ion thrusters or maybe a light sail, could you do it? And the answer is yes. It would probably bankrupt your civilization, though, to send something like the Starship Enterprise. It's just, you can't do it. It's just too much weight. And because the more weight the spacecraft has, the more fuel you need, and it gets into ridiculous amounts. But if you have a probe that weighs only 20 pounds, that's doable. You could actually send that within a few hundred years to a very close-by star system that maybe you've targeted because you've sensed in your telescopes that there are habitable planets in that star system. So, of course, this brings up the great science fiction premise, what if one of these 20-pound probes landed in your backyard and it has an automated manufacturing setup and it starts building things from your soil in your backyard? Who are the first persons that the probe encounters? How does the showdown happen? So I thought, well, this will be a fun idea for a book. And it takes place right here in New York City, in Inwood Hill Park, which is like the most deserted part of Manhattan, where the ProGlans because it wants to tap into the Con Edison power line. So that's what it's programmed to do. So anyway, that's called the Orion Plan, and it's coming out in February, my next thriller for adults.
Oh, that sounds awesome. So with New Horizons and Pluto, we're all waiting with bated breath to see what Pluto's going to look like here in a couple weeks. The signal alone, if it's from a different star system, just from here to Pluto, they're talking about how hard it is to receive that signal from the probe. I can only imagine if...
And I'm sorry,
another star
Pluto's
system.
A planet.
Well, not anymore. It's a dwarf planet.
No.
But it's going to be a planet again now after this. It will.
The
it
funny
will.
Thing is, they launched this mission a long time ago, back, I think it's 2004. I edited a story about this mission by Alan Stern, who is the principal investigator for the mission at Southwest Institute. And I remember when I was editing the story, I was thinking, wow, it's going to take more than 10 years to get to Pluto. It's really, really far. And so the spaceship has to go really, really fast to go that kind of distance. So it does these gravity assist maneuvers where it does a slingshot maneuver around the planet to speed itself out to Pluto. But because it's going so fast, there's no way that the spacecraft can be go into orbit around Pluto. It's going way too fast. It can't be. Pluto is a small body. It can't capture it. So what it's going to do is it's going to come within 7,000 miles of the planet. Really close. And its cameras are so good that they say that if those cameras were looking at Earth, looking at Central Park in New York City from that distance, they would be able to see the location of every single small pond in the park. The cameras are that good. But the thing is, you're right, it takes, I think, around 5 hours for a signal from Pluto to travel to Earth just because it's so darn far. And so they're going to set it up automatically to take photos as it whizzes by Pluto, but we won't know if those photos actually came out until the probe is way past the planet, like something like a million miles past the planet. So I think it's the most exciting thing, one of the most exciting missions in science right now.
Yeah, I just find it fascinating that it literally only takes 5 hours to get a signal from Pluto to the United States to see the pictures. I mean, I would think it'd be like 5 years. I mean, 5 hours, that's incredible.
And it's such a narrow band, too, it's being sent on, that you've got to have all these transceivers to pick it up.
Well, I can't wait. So last thing, of course, is let everybody know, you know, where they're at, where they can find you, social media, Facebook, whatever you want to let everybody know, where can they find you at?
Sure. Well, the best place to find out about all of my books is my website, which is markalpert.com. And there I have descriptions not only of all my books for adults and all my books for young adults, but I also have descriptions of the science behind the books. Because that's part of what my goal is, to try to get people to learn more about it. And so I have a lot of information about particle physics and genetic immortality and robotic mind. So all of that is right there on my website. That's probably the best place to go. And, of course, all the buy links are on there, too.
Yeah. Fascinating. Mark, thanks so much for joining us for these couple minutes. It's been great. Again, thanks so much for coming on.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you.
All right.
So there we have it, Jeff. Two down. Mark Alpert. Great interview. That was a great guy.
Oh, he was a lot of fun. I'm glad he was able to do that with us.
Yeah, first time I had even really known who he was, so that was good. You set that one up, and I think that was a great, another great way to just introduce fans to him, because I didn't really know who he was.
And I've been reading his book since his very first one, and it was nice to just sit down and chat with him.
And you know what else is really great, too? Suspense Magazine is able to kind of give you these things. And Coffee Town Press and Camel Press, they're the same company. They just brought out 6 gripping new mysteries. One of them is called Trouble in Rooster Paradise. Another one, and that's by T.W. Emery. Then you have When Devil's Idol by Lita Serafin. Leslie Deal, A Sporting Murder. And then there's so much more. So what you want to do is that if you want any information, you can always email them at info@camelpress.com, but make sure you go and check out those sites. Coffee Town Press and Camel Press is the publisher, and check out their books. Again, there's a lot of great publishers that are out there that are a little smaller. They need our support to go check out their books, because they're not one of the big boys doesn't mean that they don't have fantastic, terrific authors. So you go out there and check out these smaller presses and see the kind of great stuff that goes on. Do you agree, Jeff?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think you got to check that out. You know, just because the big ones are always in your face, everybody had to start off small one time, and it's these kind of companies like this, Dispense Publishing, literal companies that are really trying to push and test some great, great books. All right, let's hit it for our last interview of the night, none other than mega author Sandra Brown, who we have found out in the interview, 77 books she has written, 66 have made the New York Times list. That, excuse my pun, is fucking incredible.
She's only written, she writes 3-4 books a year at that rate. Good grief.
Mm-hmm.
More like 10, actually.
I know, that's like incredible. And of course, the one that we talked about a little bit in here was Rainwater, which was, aside from all the other stuff she's ever written, and it just came out a couple years ago, it was a totally different book. It was a little bit more literary. People have called it a Steinbeck novel. And we had to find out why she decided to do that. And that story is fascinating. We, this is the first time we were able to speak with Sandra Brown. And I'm going to tell you right now, people, she is mesmerizing when you see her in person to talk with her. We didn't want her to stop. So, without any further ado, here we go. Sandra Brown at Thriller Fest 2015.
So here we are again at Thriller Fest. Jeff was with me, of course, and we have mega best-selling author. Now we found out 77 books published. That's amazing. Sandra Brown. So Sandra, thank you so much for joining us
thank
for these couple
you,
minutes.
John. Thank you. My pleasure.
So we've been asking all the authors right out of the gate because this is the 10th anniversary of Thriller Fest. And so we would like to know, what does Thriller Fest mean to you? And what should a young author or aspiring author, maybe he's coming for the first time, what should they expect when they come to an event like this?
Well, I didn't come to it as a new author. So I was a veteran long before there was a Thriller Fest. And what it has meant to me is each year that I'm here getting to talk to my friends and cronies. You know, we're friends on Twitter, we're friends on Facebook, we're friends, you know, by email. But there's just something about, you know, getting to meet people that I admire and whose books I read face-to-face. And so it's always just a fun reunion each year. In terms of what a new writer can expect, I think this conference, as much as any and almost better than any, really caters to beginning writers. They provide so many, and I say they because I never have anything to do with the planning. I can't take any credit whatsoever. But those who do plan it really have the interest of the new fledgling author in mind. And they provide such a diversity of panels. Because even under the Thriller umbrella, there are so many subgenres. You yes. know, there's the espionage, the military, the romantic suspense, almost horror, sci-fi. I mean, so it really covers a broad spectrum. And as one of my colleagues said at one of these conferences, he said every book really should be a thriller. Your goal as a fiction author is to thrill your audience. And so I think they've kept a very open mind in terms of the definition of the genre, and therefore it draws from a lot of others. And they really provide insightful seminars and the accessibility of the stars of the genre. You know, they really are allowed to mix and mingle, and new writers, as I was very intimidated the first conference I went to, I can imagine their intimidation, you mm-hmm. know, and see somebody that they, you know, admire so much. It's sometimes hard to go up and just begin a conversation, and yet everyone who comes to this conference appears to be, to me, extremely accessible and open to talking to new authors.
Well, that's what, yeah, it's true, it's true. Getting to talk to you right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly. This is why we're here.
This is so much fun. And I was just thinking, you're mentioning every book should be a thriller, and I was thinking James Joyce should have gotten that memo. But seriously.
Well, I think we could all name a few.
Jeff likes the zingers.
Sorry. I wonder if you can talk about your beginning writing and sort of, you didn't start off writing thrillers, essentially.
Right.
What made you want to go into that field?
Well, I started writing romances because that's what was selling. And I had always you know, had in mind doing, you know, larger books or books with more intrigue, more mystery, more suspense, if you will. But when I began and I sent a manuscript off to a published author who had offered to read my work, and she gave me two pieces of advice, which were very good. She said, "You've got a great voice," talking about how I handle the language and the command of the language. She said, "You've got great characters, but you really need how to structure a plot." And I was going, "Oh, really? There's structure to a plot?" You know, it was terminology that just I hadn't heard and didn't know. The other thing she said was, and I would recommend that you start writing romances, because that kind of seems to be, you know, where you're headed. And I said, "Well, like what? What's a romance?" And she said, "Well, like, you know, Harlequin is looking for American authors." I never read a Harlequin romance. And so
neither have I, don't worry.
I went to the store and bought like 12, and they were wonderful. And mm-hmm. I thought, I see what she's talking about, I can do this. But I also did my homework. I also bought and borrowed a lot of how to write best-selling fiction. And I studied them as though they were textbooks. I really put myself through, you know, courses, if you will, of character development, sustaining suspense, all of these things, and how to structure a plot that will sell, that an editor would recognize as such. And I went back, took those early manuscripts, and restructured them and applied everything I learned. And shortly after that, I did sell my first book. But in terms, and then I wrote like, with a frenzy, and I wrote like 45 romances. Whew. And I was writing.
And that was Tuesday.
And then on Wednesday, I brushed up my act, and uh-huh. I thought, okay. No, I did, it was about 8 years, 7 or 8 years into my career, and I thought, I really can't expand on this. I've done it, I've kind of said it, and so I started looking around to paint on a larger canvas, and I wanted to start incorporating more suspense and mystery elements into my books. And I had given all my editors heart attacks anyway, because I would say, "Gosh, I'm thinking of this story, and this," and they were like, "Oh, you can't do that in romance." Now, this goes back, now you can do anything. But mm-hmm. back then, in the ancient days, when we were barely out of the chisel and rock stage of publishing, you know, there were certain taboos that, first of all, women authors weren't supposed to even know about. And secondly, right. It would have been hard to, you know, to market and sell, because there was just no market there for it. And so I was, you know, but I was feeling so constricted by these invisible parameters. So I said, "Well, you really kind of can do it." Don't tell me I can't, because you really kind of can. And so I started, you know, just pressing the envelope until finally I wrote what was called a crossover book. And that was really where, you know, it's like, "Oh my gosh, what's happened to Sandra Brown? She used to be such a nice girl." But it caught, you know, publishers' attention, who saw me as someone who might could move out of just genre series books and start writing standalone, you know, more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And they gave me a leg up. So
now your newest book comes out in August, and it's uh-huh. called Friction.
Yes.
And from reading what it is, it pretty much says it all in the title right there, does it not?
There's a story to that title.
Oh, we got to hear it.
I had my story, and I was well into like the third draft, and didn't have a title yet. So, you know, the publisher starts getting antsy. Any ideas on the title? Because they want to start promoting it in their catalogs and everything. And I was like, "Yeah, let me think of it. So I came up with what I thought was a great title. And it had the word hell in it. And some of the major accounts, who shall remain nameless, said, "We won't buy it."
Hmm.
And I mean, these are major accounts. It was nobody I could sneeze at. And so I said, well, there's no way I can use it, you know, and no way in hell I can use it. And so I had to come up with another. And the book was in, edited, literally on its way to production. And they said, we've got to have a title. So I thought, what in the world can I do? And there were, I was thinking grudge, that there's this deep-seated grudge in the book between the hero and someone he doesn't even know bears him this grudge, but it's severe. It's the basis of the whole thing. And so I was looking up in my word finder, which is a dictionary thing about this thick, and it's synonyms and antonyms. And so I looked up the word grudge, and I was going up, and there was friction. And I went, oh, and it was like that, you know,
that aha moment.
That bubble of excitement. Yes. That just like, and so my editor was literally at sales conference. They were presenting all of the fall books to the accounts, and she kept saying, you know, it'd be really great if I could present it as something other than Untitled Sandra Brown. And so I called her, and I said, have you done whatever they call it, introduction to the book yet? She said, no, it's tomorrow. I said, what about friction? And she said, oh, I love it. I love it. And it sounds like a Sandra Brown book.
Yeah.
And so she bounced it off several people in marketing. They all loved it. So the next day, she got to go in and say the title of Sandra Brown's book. So it was literally right under the wire. And then it was so perfect. And so much better than the other title would have been. So these things happen for a reason.
I didn't realize you could swear in a manuscript of the actual book itself, but not in the title of the book.
I guess you can't use hell. I knew that. I learned that
even 77 books and 66 New York Times, you still can't have hell in the title.
And I see other words.
Oh yeah, we do.
And so I'm just like, really?
And I see some of the covers, not just the titles,
but they aren't carried
in those chains or whatever that Yahoo not my name.
They were, as I say, and it was not just one. I think it was two, maybe three, but said we won't display a book. And so I was just like, you've got to be kidding me, really. And it's not, it wasn't even used like a curse word. It was Hellbent was going to be the title.
That's
such a pretty benign expression. Yes.
After watching TV and things today, they said no to that.
Obviously, they haven't seen Sons of Anarchy.
My goodness.
But anyway, but I got a great title out of the experience, and it just goes to show. Some titles come very, very easy, like Mean Streak. I knew the minute I started plotting the book what the title was going to be, because I was thinking of the character, and I thought, you know, he seems very, as you said, benign. He seems very benign and harmless, but he's got to have a really mean streak. And I went, that's it.
There you go.
And so the title was there almost instantly. Other books, sometimes it does come down to, I'll be in the, you know, very last few drafts, and the publisher's waiting on me to come up. So, but it has to be right. And you have to feel that aha moment.
Now, I was having, Doug Lyle and Kathy Antrim and some other authors have read the book Rainwater. And they absolutely think it's one of your best works, if not probably in your top three of all time. And so they said, and I said, I'm interviewing you. And they asked me, they said, okay, you have to ask her, what was the inspiration for you to break away a little bit and write that kind of a book? Because that is so much different than your whole catalog.
Yeah. Two things, John. One was very similar experience to the events that take place in Rainwater happened to my daddy when he was 6 years old. It was 1934 at the height of the Depression in Central Texas where everybody was poor. But I won't go into all of it, but my grandfather was a dairy farmer, and a federal mandate passed by Congress in January of that year said that some commodities, they had to create a false demand, which the theory was would drive up the price. So it was like beef, poultry, eggs, milk. So the thing was, if you couldn't sell your milk to dairies for distribution and pasteurization, all that, then you had to pour it out.
Wow.
My grandfather, who had quite a herd of dairy cattle, was taking his surplus milk to the shantytown and giving it to indigent families, hungry people. And the federal agents came several times with warnings, and the next time they came with guns and were going to force him, and he and my gun-toting from Texas said, no. And there was a standoff for like 3 days, and no bullets were fired to my knowledge, but this made a significant impression on my daddy, who was also a writer. He was an editorial writer for the newspaper. And he wrote about this, and I read it one time, and I was just like, this really happened? You know, Papa and all the cousins and everybody. I mean, it was really kind of a big deal. But federal agents withdrew. Grandpa continued to give away his unsold milk. So that just, you know, inflamed my imagination. And then the second element to this story is that I always kind of sort of wanted to base a story on that. And into my subconscious came Ella and Mr. Rainwater. And they just would not leave me alone. And I kept saying, there's no market for you. No one is going to buy this book. It would be like, you know, just something that I wanted to do. They just were like, tell our story. So between contract books, I just started writing one day. Just opened it up to see what would happen. And I became so engrossed in this story. And I didn't know anything that was going to happen. And so it was just like it just unfolded on its own.
Wow.
And so I would work on it. Nobody knew I was working on it except my husband. And I didn't tell my agent. So I'd get it out, you know, work on it like for a couple of weeks, put it away, work on my contract book. But anytime I got a break, I would just play with it. And this story just became so compelling to me. So after I had gotten a draft where I kind of wanted it, one weekend, I sent it to my agent, and I said, this is just something I've been playing with. Read it when you have time. And she said, well, what is it? And I said, well, just read it. It's about 350 pages or whatever it was, and at your leisure. Well, she called me on Monday. She said, I've already read it twice. And she said, it's got to go to Jamie, or my editor at the time, not Jamie, got to go tomorrow. And I said, oh no, I need to do at least one more, you know,
pass through
on it, get some of the exact research on these government programs correct and everything. And she said, well, when you can. So I worked on it probably another 6 months, and when I could, and then I sent it to the editor, and then they fell in love with it. So, and a lot of people, I would love to do something similar, but the story has to be there. You know, it's like, I would love to revisit a time period like that and kind of capture that time period and the effect, the impact that it had on the people's lives. And in the book, Ella is a single woman, which first of all, automatically at that time and her age, kind of made her an oddball anyway. And nobody knew what had happened to her husband. And she was raising a son who was autistic. At the time, autism had not even been named.
Mm-hmm.
The term idiot savant had kind of been bounced around, but that came from Europe. In the United States, in Central Texas, he was Mrs. Barron's backward boy. You know, that was kind of cool. the terminology at the time. And so I thought, what would it have been like for her, you know, to be by herself, to trying to be surviving in this economic depression, and to have this constant worry that he was going to be taken and locked away somewhere, you know. So, and then into her life comes Mr. Rainwater. And it was just a wonderful, and I say this because I don't feel like I did it. I feel like the story found me, and I just reported it. I thought it was a wonderful story, and I would love for another one to show up on my doorstep and say, write me.
I'm going to have to ask my mother about that, because she's born and raised in San Antonio.
Oh, really?
And she was born in, I better not say that. So... I'm not going to say the year, because if she finds out, she'll be like, now people know how old I am. But I had no idea about that until my wife had read the book, and then she goes, this is what it's about. And then the concept of just fascinating.
And the all of the Plains states during like 34 and 35, but 34 was probably the worst, because that by then the Dust Bowl had caught up with the Depression and helped worsen it. And the ranchers, farmers, anybody who, cultivated any kind of livestock could not feed them.
Wow.
And so in 1 month alone in Texas, they slaughtered 700,000 heads of cattle, driving them into pits and shooting them. So it wasn't just that the ranchers were, they couldn't afford to feed their families. Their livelihoods were being destroyed. Now, they got paid pennies on the dollar for certain viable cattle who could then be slaughtered for the soup kitchens. But most of them, and I saw a lot of wiggle room for corruption there, because the government agents, decided which cattle could be spared and which not. But, I mean, it was from a family's milk cow. If they couldn't afford to feed it,
They
had to put it down. I mean, right there. It was an awful time.
Well, we know your time is short because you have a panel that's coming up. Oh, and here's your panel master in like 45 minutes. And so, but this has been fascinating. I could sit here for 3 hours and just listen to you. I mean, without a doubt.
I know, I was going to ask another question. I looked at the date. Yeah.
So,
I'm fine. You probably got another interview, but.
He's not till 14 minutes, so you want to go for another 10. We're good to go. Go ahead. So.
I'm not going anywhere but to the panel.
I'm going to ask you another question.
Ask it away.
So you've written some wonderful stories. You were mentioning stories. Mm-hmm. What do you consider the Sandra Brown brand?
Well, I think publishers have been looking for that, searching for that for the past 35 years, and I'm kind of an odd duck. They really haven't pigeonholed me ever. Which to me is sort of,
kind of.
A compliment.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because I have been sort of all over the map. And if anybody ever said, what do you write? I try to say, I try to write a story that hasn't been done before. It's got a new cast of characters. I start from scratch every day. And it's been, from a marketing standpoint, it would have been so much simpler and probably a lot more lucrative for my career had I done a series character that people then, gravitate toward, and they can't wait for the next, book to come out with that character. But I just don't have that attention span, I guess it is, because I admire my colleagues who do that and do it so darn well. I mean, they maintain their audience's loyalty and readership and interest in that character. So obviously they have done it right. I just think that after a time I would get bored with just one character. So when I've finished a story, I'm ready to go on to the next, and it's totally different. In terms of trademarking Sandra Brown, last year, the publisher came up, or they hired somebody to come up with kind of a tagline for me, and it was Sexy, Suspenseful Sandra Brown. Well, my husband was thrilled and also surprised. But it was I get that, because I guess if you tried to pigeonhole me, it was like, she writes kind of these sexy mystery suspense thriller novels, but it beyond that, it's not medical, it's not a detective, it's not a policeman, it's not a military person, it's not. So I like to mix it up, And if I guess what I would like to be known for is that typically I try to really surprise the reader. I like the element of surprise. And when I sit down to write a book, I kind of have the, you know, the characters in place. I know what the terrible trouble is going to be, the catalytic event that kind of starts everything. And I know basically how it's going to end. The one, and I build in a few peaks, but then usually the surprises surprise the heck out of me. After I put everybody in place, I just kind of let it unfold itself, and some of the best plot twists I've had, I didn't see coming. And I think, gosh, that is so good. You know, it's so fun. But the other thing that I ask myself, when everything is in place, but it's not quite a story yet, and that's the tough thing, because not all, even great ideas, sometimes don't want to be a story. And I know it's a story when I figure out what I know that the character does, that the reader doesn't.
Interesting.
And it's like, what do I know that the reader doesn't? And that's the secret. And I try to implant a question in their mind on the first page, if possible, certainly by the end of the prologue. And it's a sublineal thing, but I try to plant a question there, and I try to keep from answering it until the very last page. And that's the thing that I know that the reader doesn't. And sometimes it's even the character doesn't. Yeah.
That's tremendous. Well, Sandra, I'll tell you what, and you know, we should just put on a thing, just say she writes a hell of a story.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
I was going to say, she's a great storyteller.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, but...
Absolutely. And I'm going to be diving into Friction when I get home, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. I hope you like it.
Well, when you see the AP review, you'll know.
And there will be that thing that I know that nobody else knows until the very end of the book.
Awesome.
You'll go, that's what she's talking
about.
That's what she's
talking about. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. It has been fantastic.
So nice to meet you.
Yes.
Now, where are you? Where do y'all live? Or do you live different places?
There it is. You just heard Sandra Brown's secret to her writing. You heard it right there. I don't think she's told that any place, but she told us. She loved us. She was such a great lady. And you could tell that she is from Texas, without a doubt.
She was an amazing person. It was great.
She was. All right, man. There we go. Thriller Fest 2015 interviews are off and running. We are going to be back with you. We're going to figure out the time. So check out suspenseradionetwork.com. I'm going to start putting up when we're going to do this. And again, Hank Philip P. Ryan, Jamie Frevoletti. We have John Land. We have Scott Turow. We have Joseph Fender. We have Joseph Badal, we have Peter James, we got Robert Wilson, we got them all coming for you when we have them. So make sure that you check them all out. So Jeff, it's been great to talk with you again, and what a great show.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great.
All right, everybody, until next time, we will see you all again. Keep reading. Later, everybody.